what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
And a hearty good afternoon to everybody. So good to have you along with us today. Oh my, what a beautiful day it is here in Southwest Florida. Of course, it's paradise. It ought to be nice. And I hope it's nice where you are as well. I'm hearing stories from all around the country that summer is here, although not quite officially yet. I forget what day that is. It's mid-June, later June. But it's here. Summer's here for all intents and purposes. Maybe you folks up in Idaho and all that don't quite have summer yet, but in Montana. But most of us do, anyway. At least it's touched upon us. I know it's certainly warm in Washington, D.C. I don't know that there's any place in the country where it seems hotter than Washington, D.C. in the dead of summer. Have to go there in a couple of weeks. We're going to cover that Take Back America conference. And we're going to do our show live from there on a Monday and Tuesday, the 12th and 13th. That'll be a hoot. There's going to be a lot of interesting people there. Hillary's going to be there. Barack Obama. Let me see who else. Robert Redford. John Conyers. Lots of people. All the big names will be there. The Take Back America conference. And it's going to be a good time had by all, a very interesting time had by all, I can guarantee you that. And if you'd like to find out more information about that and what all is going to go on and who's sponsoring it and so forth, you can go to ourfuture.org, ourfuture.org, and you can find out all about the Take Back America conference that's going to take place 12th, 13th, and 14th of June. In good old Washington, D.C. So we got the airplane all fired up. We got the rooms ready to rock and roll and head up there and bring you some great programming. And our friends from the Head On Radio Network are going to be there as well. Our cohorts, our sister, well, I shouldn't say sister shows because none of them are girls. Our brother shows. However, we have to figure out a proper way to say that. We do have an interesting program for you today. I've got a guest coming up in about a half hour. His name is Michael Blake. Mike is from the Iraq Veterans Against the War. He is a vet. You will find him fascinating to talk to. I know you're going to enjoy that interview. That's not just some kind of a tease. You will enjoy the interview with Michael Blake. We have a lot in common, not militarily, but our thoughts are certainly in common with he and I and with most of you I know full well. What else have we got on the agenda today? Oh, we had a terrorist attack in Florida. Did you hear about it? Man, it was big news. I mean, really big news. A horrible, horrible terrorist attack in Florida. It took place in Waldo, Florida. The story that was sent to me says religious extremists using chemical weapon at a small bookstore. Not Muslims bombing a border store or anything like that. No, no, no. Christians attacking an adult bookstore. Detectives say it's an act of local terrorism. An adult bookstore is cleaning up after a chemical attack by a homemade device that investigators are calling a weapon of mass destruction in Waldo, Florida. People have held prayer vigils and protests aimed at an adult bookstore along U.S. 301, trying to keep the Cafe Risque from opening its doors on time. Those efforts have all failed, so investigators say it looks like someone has turned to what they're calling a clear act of terrorism to keep the store's owner from opening up shop. The device discovered Sunday morning was made of 2-gallon-sized sports drink jugs connected by hoses, and someone set it on top of the store's air conditioning system. So, don't know what was in it, but there you have it. There you have it, huh? Breaking news. Well, it happened yesterday, but terrorist act in Florida, right there. And it wasn't those Muslims doing it this time, hmm? Oh, we've got stories today about Bob Ney. We've got stories just about about so many different things. We got a letter from a veteran today. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Homeland Security grants that have been just totally screwed up as usual. And of course, we got a couple funny little things to talk about as well. And something that's not so funny, you know, one of our listeners sent me a email, and not too long ago, about 1:30 this afternoon, I got this. And it breaks my heart when I read this, but she's absolutely right. And, you know, I tell you about our friends in other countries, what they must think of what's going on here now. Very simple email. Short and not so sweet, but to the point. And Jocelyn, thank you very much for sending this. President, she says, President Clinton once said, whatever is wrong with America can be fixed by what is right with America. She said, I used to believe that. Sadly, I don't anymore. Oh, boy. I wrote back to her that, sadly, I'm starting to head her way, starting to agree with that. We shall see. And we've got some other humorous things to talk about later on in the program. You know, we had Sid Blumenthal on the show a couple of times over the years that we've been on. Sid, a very intellectual guy, but great to talk to nonetheless, and you won't find anybody smarter and more astute on political matters than Sid Blumenthal. Of course, he worked in the Clinton White House. And I was reading an article by Sid Blumenthal, and he believes that we're facing a constitutional crisis. And actually, I should say, he thinks we're facing constitutional crises. And I totally agree. King George, under the advice of his chief barrister of the kingdom, Alberto Gonzalez, has taken the position that the Constitution does not apply to the king during a time of war, and that the king may, with impunity, decide that he does not have the obligation to abide by any part of the Constitution if he doesn't feel like it. And folks, that's just exactly what he's done 750 times since he's been in office, written those little signing statements on bills, plus other lawbreaking activities. Now, since there is not in the foreseeable future any end in sight to the Bush War, then to my mind, it follows that the Constitution of the United States of America no longer applies as any kind of lawful document with which to govern this country. At least that's the way Bush sees it. Sid Blumenthal believes, and I agree with him, that in essence we're looking at three separate constitutional crises. And let me just spell them out for you. I think they're very clear. I think they're very simple to understand. First of all, the freedom of the press is at stake. I think you all know that. You've seen examples of why it's at stake recently. A couple of weeks ago, Barrister Gonzalez stated that most likely the New York Times would be prosecuted for publishing its Pulitzer Prize-winning article about Junior Bush's domestic NSA spying scandal. And Gonzalez said, and I quote him, "It can't be the case that the First Amendment trumps the right of the government to go after criminal activity. Mr. Gonzalez, I would like to know who decided what the New York Times did was criminal activity. I would like to know, Mr. Gonzalez, do you now have the authority granted by the king to throw out the amendments to the Constitution of the United States and decide for yourself what is and what is not lawful? They're acting as such. It's plain as day to see every day." The second constitutional crisis that I believe is happening is that the executive branch very well may assert that a member of the executive branch during wartime is above the law. And you know where we're going with this. As you all know, Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald has charged Dark Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Libby, with perjury and obstruction of justice, and has made known his intentions to call Vice President Cheney to the witness stand to either destroy Libby's credibility or to commit perjury himself. But here's the rub. It's highly likely that the administration will tell Fitzgerald to take a hike because the executive branch is immune from such distractions during time of war. They're going to use that over and over and over again. The third constitutional crisis may come if the Democrats take either the House or the Senate in the fall elections. And since the congressional oversight has been totally stifled during the Bush administration, it is likely that the Democrats would bring it back, and probably with a vengeance. And if that happens, they'll be asking for documents pertaining to things they believe the Bush administration has done illegally. Remember when they had the door slammed in their faces when they asked for documents concerning Cheney's secret energy meetings during Bush's first term? Well, they're going to go after documents like that. And Bush, on the advice of Gonzalez, is likely to tell them to, you know, to go someplace, take a hike. That's what Bush will tell them. What these bozos don't realize, or maybe they do and just don't give a damn, is that the Constitution created a system of checks and balances to make sure no one would be able to pull off things like Cheney's secret meetings with people like Kenny Boy Lay of Enron fame and rob the public blind like they obviously did and are continuing to do even today, with their total lack of cooperation concerning doing a damn thing about energy prices, which are spiraling out of control and devastating the financial security of millions of our citizens. The crux of the matter is here, will the Bush administration be able to get away with claiming that we're in a continual state of war and therefore continue to suspend whatever portion of the Constitution that it suits them to violate at their discretion? That's the question. And if the Democrats do take over the House or the Senate, I can't wait to get the answer. I think there will be political hell to pay. I really do. It's fascinating for me to see how many Democrats are running from the subject of impeachment and investigations and all. And they are. They're running away from it. I wonder. I mean, I really do wonder about even so many of our Democratic legislators, and you've heard me say it, I don't leave them off the hook. So many times on this show, we talk about that. I think it's time for another Tea Party. I do. I was thinking about this the other day. Taxation without representation. You know, that was their cry, and it's happening once again. It really is. We pay taxes, income tax, state tax, sales tax, gas tax, what else? Property tax, every kind of tax that you can possibly imagine. We all pay taxes, and maybe even some taxes we can't imagine. And maybe that's a good thing, and not maybe it's a good thing, it is a good thing. We need to build good schools and staff them well. We need to pave our roads. We need a good defense department. We need most of the government services we get. And I won't ever quarrel with being taxed as long as the taxes are fair and equitable to everyone. However, I will squawk about being taxed without representation. And I have to ask, and I will ask, who among you, and think about this, really. Trying to think of a good way to put this. Really. I want to be gentle with this and say it the right way. Don't want to get arrested this afternoon. really, when it comes down to it, who among you feels truly represented by your by your respective local, state, or federal elected officials right now? Anybody? Raise your hand. Do you feel? You know, forget your local level. Maybe you got your local commissioner or your city councilman or like that that you think is doing a good job for you. But your state and federal elected officials right now, do any of you feel really well represented? Your views, are they well represented in your state and federal government right now? I know for a fact that many pieces of people within the sound of my voice right this minute are paying taxes and not getting any representation whatsoever. What they are getting is some guy or gal they elected giving lip service to the wants and needs of the voters and then doing the bidding of the fat cats who paid for their political campaigns. That's what they are getting. You know, think about that. Who among you feels that you've got any chance whatsoever against a lobbyist for the pharmaceutical industry when it comes to getting legislation through Congress to benefit you instead of Big Pharma? You got any chance at all? How many lobbyists was it? 400 for the pharmaceutical industry that went after him on that phony pharmaceutical bill, prescription bill? And who among you thinks that the lobbyist from ExxonMobil doesn't have the ear of your congressman or senator when it comes to legislation pertaining to energy costs and availability? Anybody? And who among you thinks that you have any chance at all against the lobbyists from the banks, from Citicorp, Bank America, Wachovia, Chase Manhattan, Wells Fargo? Let's see, there must be some others I can't think of right now. And the blood-sucking leeches from some of the credit card companies, the MBNA and the, who else, Capital One. Who amongst you thinks you've got any chance at all against the lobbyists of those companies when it comes to legislation that might protect consumers from terrible abuses from these companies? Let me tell you, you don't have any chance at all. You don't. You don't have any chance at all, and all you have to do is take a look at how the bankruptcy bill turned out. To any decent standard you want to name, that bill was an abomination against the average working man and woman in this country. And still, most of our legislators voted in favor of it. Were you represented against the banks and credit card vultures like Capital One and MBNA? Not the way I see it, you weren't. You know you weren't. You know you were sold out. Every single one of you were sold out. And you can't say, you cannot sit there and say, well, you know, the bankruptcy bill doesn't affect me. You know, maybe it hasn't. And to the great majority of you, it has not affected you. But it might someday. It might. You might lose your job. You might have a medical emergency in your home. And things could get tough. And you might need the protection of bankruptcy against some of these vultures. But you won't get it. Not anymore. You'll be an indentured servant for the rest of your life on account of that bankruptcy bill. If the time should ever come that you would need it. Now, I know there were abuses of bankruptcy. We all know that. But it certainly wasn't the pitiful story that the banks went and told at the hearings in front of the Congress, or the stories they went and told the senators and congressmen over it. Oh, we're suffering horrible losses over bankruptcy. Yeah, right. Record profits for these financial institutions, and they were... So anyway, I think it's time to dump a little tea in the harbor once again. I really do. It might even be time for another revolution. I think Thomas Jefferson, I believe, is the guy that said a good revolution might not be a bad idea every now and then. I paraphrased it, but that's what he said in essence. And I think now's the time. And I think we need to somehow show our legislators that we're serious about it. Taxation without representation. We are not being represented. Actually, you know, the real thing that got the revolution started in this country, and I, you know, you all know about the Boston Tea Party and all that, but a little known fact, I think the real reason I always like to boil things clear down to the bottom. You know, when I was a kid, I helped make maple syrup, so you always boil everything down to what's finally left. And I think when you boil it all the way down to the bottom, it wasn't the tea in the harbor that actually started the revolution in this country. It started sometime before that. The first step in inaugurating the new system, the revolution, was the passage of the, trying to think what it was called for sure, the Sugar Act, I believe, of 1762, 1763, 1764, right in that neighborhood. It was an act that was designed to, by the British, to raise revenue without regulating trade. And they'd already, stay with me here. I've got a place I'm going with this. I hope I've got my facts straight. I get off in these tangents and I think, geez, I hope my memory's got me going okay here. There was an act the British had toward the colonies back in the 1730s. It was called the Molasses Act. And what the deal was, it had placed a prohibitive duty on the import of rum and molasses from non-English areas. See, they wanted all the money in their pot. And so they came along with this new Sugar Act in the 1860s, the early 1860s some kind, and it forbade the importation of foreign rum, and it put a small duty on molasses and all that, and they brought, the difference was when this new act was, they brought British warships in to actually enforce this one. This was the difference. The Sugar Act of 1860, whatever, and the Molasses Act of 1730, what, they were basically the same. Not a lot of difference between two, but the difference was, is the British decided to enforce this Sugar Act. And so they brought warships into the harbor to seize the goods of the smugglers. And what it boiled down to, it was all over liquor. It was over that demon rum and all. We were, the colonies were importing it, so the British didn't know about it, so we didn't have to pay tax on it. And people like Samuel Adams, I think there's a booze, a beer or something named after him now. He was involved in that. So it started long before the tea in the harbor, but an interesting story. You probably need to go back and take a look at the Stamp Act and all those things that happened back then. But it was a gradual buildup, kind of like what's going on now. The fire was lit. There was a little spark, and then a small fire, and then it gradually grew into a raging bonfire. And I hope that doesn't happen now. But we are not being represented. We feel just like, I feel right now, just like the citizens of the colonies did back in those days, that they were being taxed. And they had no say in the taxes. The king was passing the Stamp Act on them, and the tea tax on the tea and the liquor and all this and that. And they had no elected representatives in the parliament. And they wanted a say in what was going on here. And that's what led to the American Revolution. That's what's happening now. I do not feel, on both sides of the aisle, that we are being properly represented. And if you feel that your congressman, your senator, is properly representing you, and you're completely satisfied with all their votes, and I know we'll never be completely satisfied with all their votes, but I'd like to hear from you. 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. I'd like to know if you're satisfied with how things are going. Do you feel well represented in the Congress of the United States? Do you feel you would be welcome, and I say that with tongue firmly planted in cheek, would you be welcome if you went and knocked on your senator's door in the Hart Senate office building? Do you think you would be welcome? I can tell you right now what happens. You get met in the outer office. They have a whole complex of offices, each one of the Senate offices. You would be amazed at the number of people in each one of the Senate offices, especially the higher up the food chain they go. And you'd be amazed at how luxurious some of the Senate offices are. They get quite a nice little stipend to furnish their offices. But you'll get as far as the reception desk, and they'll ask, what's your name? And you're here to see Senator Joe What's-His-Name. And I am Citizen John Smith from Joe What's-His-Name's state. Of course, that's the only way you would ever have a chance if you were from his state. You wouldn't if you were not from his constituency. And they will politely tell you, well, the senator is busy or the senator's not in. You may not see the senator today. They're very polite about it. They're very nice about it. They get a little ugly if you insist. But you are not going to walk in there without an appointment. Even if he's back there twiddling his thumb doing the crossword puzzle, you will not get in to see your senator. That's just how it is. It's the royalty. And you, my friends, are not part of the royalty. Let's go to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hey, Guy, how you doing?
Good. Hey, can you turn your radio down a little bit in the background? We're getting a cross feed here.
Just a second.
I guess I could have brought my guitar. We could sing a song. Hello.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, we get feedback.
I'm very sorry.
Yeah, what's on your mind today?
No, I would be welcome.
You would be welcome?
Would not be.
Oh, you would not be? Well,
yeah. I mean, I used to work in D.C., and I used to have to see these people officially. It's hard enough to see them when you go in to see them officially. But as a constituent, the only time you ever see most of them is when they've got their hand out for a vote or a donation.
Exactly right. The office person, if they would go so far as to buzz them back in the office, Senator What's-His-Name, and say, Senator What's-His-Name, one of your constituents is out here to see you. The answer would be, well, no, I'm heading for a meeting right now. Now, if you were to walk in there and say, I am from Martin Marietta, or I'm from Raytheon, or I'm from Boeing.
Little Coleman.
You'll get right in. Come right on in, and you know, you'll probably have some gifts in your pockets for the senator, or for some of the senators anyway. That's how it works.
That's it. Exactly how it works. And, you know, basically, you don't have the opportunity to come face-to-face. Now, I'll admit, my local federal representative staff is very good, and they're very conscientious about answering a constituent request. But as far as, you know, the seeing the top man is concerned, they're just basically unapproachable and unattainable, unless maybe it's for a photo op or something like that.
Yeah, a good photo op never hurt anybody. You take a group of kids in the senator's office and they're not busy, you might get a picture if you got a group of kids from back home with their Girl Scout uniforms on or something like that.
Well, you know, when they're not kissing babies, they're stealing their lollipops. Yeah. Now look, we've got the best money government can buy. The best government money can buy, excuse me.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
The best government that money can buy. And K Street runs this country, not Capitol Hill.
That's exactly right.
And K Street.
K Street, for those of you who haven't been to Washington, it's a fairly long street, K Street is, and the closer you get to the White House, the fancier the offices are. Believe it or not, I know somebody very well that's got an office on K Street, one of the better ones. And it's amazing to see some of the offices on K Street and the people that go in and out of them. They do have their influence, and they know it.
Yeah. They have palatial offices, Armani suits, and all types of chauffeured roles and Mercedes and things like that to whisk you away to the Ritz-Carlton to wine and dine. And
yep.
It's the whole thing.
Head on down to Mayflower Hotel for breakfast in the morning, you know, and have the $15 scrambled eggs. I've been there, done that, actually, and glad I didn't have to pay for it, but they weren't lobbying me.
Right.
They'd be wasting their time. Yeah.
But, you know, one little thing, and I'm gone. There's no wealth generated in Washington. It's all basically distributed there. That's the point of distribution.
That's exactly right.
And that's what it's all about. And we've really lost, in my opinion, the true vision of what our government should be about. I mean, I know money, it takes money and it takes power and influence to run things, to get things done. But, I mean, ever since the lobbyists took over, say, since Reagan came into office, I mean, good God, it's just been...
That's when it happened.
Excessive to the point of being ridiculous. And,
yep.
You know, that's it. And I appreciate your time and appreciate your program.
Hey, thanks very much.
Bye.
Good to hear from you. And you're on the Guy James Show. Hello.
I'm Alice.
Hi, Alice.
How much do you think they paid each Democratic congressman to vote for that bankruptcy?
Oh, my.
Our Democratic congressman voted for it.
Yeah.
Mike Thompson and about a dozen others sold us out.
Yeah, I've got a whole list of them that voted for it. It's shameful. It's shameful. And I cornered one of them, right? We've got one of them right here in Florida. And I'll just say it. I'll just say it. Everybody knows I'm honest about it. We've got a Democrat running for governor here in Florida.
Yeah.
His name is Jim Davis. And he's a congressman. And he voted for that bankruptcy bill. And I've told the story before on the show that I cornered him at a big to-do that we had here locally afterwards. And it was right after that bankruptcy bill, by the way, that was voted on. And cornered him and asked him about his vote. And he just plain told me that I didn't know what I was talking about. He said, I'm a United States congressman. I know about these bills. And I said, listen, I've read that bill. I've read every page, every word of that bill. I'll bet you I know more about that bill than you do. That's when he turned around and walked away.
Yeah. They don't want to be told.
No.
No, they want to do it their way.
No, it's a shame, and right there was a case. There was no explaining his vote for that. He started off with the abuse thing, and when you counter that with a good argument, then they leave. They turn around and walk away and try and tell you you're stupid. You don't know what you're talking about, and they assume everybody is. But you know what? It happens that a lot of us out here aren't so stupid.
No, that's right.
But
I hope not, Guy.
But they know that a good share, I guess we know at least around 29%, a good share of the voters aren't so smart. It's somewhere around 29%. That just aren't real smart at all, and they know that, and they try very hard to take advantage of that.
Yeah.
So there they have it, the local DNC, the DNC here in Florida, The Democrat Party of the state of Florida is just going to be really happy that I told that story, but I don't care.
No. Well, I guess,
I've got Eric Alterman's new book. I just received it in the mail. We're going to have him on while we're in Washington, I believe we're going to have him on the 12th of June, and he wrote this wonderful new book out about Franklin Roosevelt.
Oh, did he?
Would Franklin Roosevelt recognize some of what's going on today? I don't think he would.
Oh, they would happen to the.
Yes, exactly. He would ask what's happened to the Democratic Party, and Dwight Eisenhower would ask what's happened to the Republican Party. I really believe both those gentlemen would be aghast at what they would look at today.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's real interesting.
Yeah. Well, we're gonna talk about that book, and we'll interview him and have him on. Boy, what a beautiful book it is! It's got this majestic picture, photograph of Franklin Roosevelt on the front. It's just a gorgeous cover on this book. I don't think I've ever seen a cover. I mean, when I opened the Icendies and these big manila envelopes with the plastic packing around, when I pulled it out of there, I gasped. You could ask my wife. I looked at that and said, "Oh my gosh, look at this." Oh, well, but naturally, as you would guess, I'm a Roosevelt fan. So
yeah, I guess so. I am too.
Yes, I figured that. Alice, thank you for your call.
Okay.
Good to hear from you, my dear.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, there's a gal right there that. Let me see. She was quite the young lady when Franklin Roosevelt started running for office. Isn't that something? I wonder if she got to vote for him in his first term. Maybe not. By the second term, I bet she did. I happen to know how old Alice is, by the way. What a sweetheart. And she might have gotten to vote for him maybe his second term. Maybe sometime she'll call us and let us know that. But yeah, we're going to have Eric on, and it's going to be great to hear from him. It's going to be a fascinating interview. Hey, you know what? We've got lines lit up on there, and I simply have to take a little break, and I'll do that right now. And if you're on the phone, hang on. We'll be right back with you.
When Bruce and I filled in for Bob Kincaid, we didn't know what to expect, but we sure didn't expect a call from the decider.
Told Walmart to sell the Easter egg die kits, you know, the ones with the resurrection egg, and And we have we decided at Camp David that we were going to support Walmart and go with what the Lord told them and buy some of them resurrection egg kits. And, you know, I found the resurrection egg. God spoke to me through that egg. And God told me that I am the fourth member of the Holy Trinity. We're calling it the Holy Quadraphonic. And so now I'm the fourth voice of the Holy Trinity. So now I got four voices in my head. I have the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost and the Decider. I'm the Decider. I get to decide.
Don't miss Head On with Bob Kincaid weekdays 7 to 10 p.m. and Fourth Estate Radio with John Fox and Bruce Birch Saturdays 10 p.m. Eastern Time on the Head On Radio Network.
President stood in front of the jet planes. The rubble's all settled and democracy reigns. We defeated their army, taken control, dropped thousands of bombs and they've taken their toll. The oil's on fire, just like the blood of a billion Muslims.
Yes,
dragged
not
through
like
the mud, and
regular.
The world is safer with the dictator gone, and their lot will improve with our corporate pawn. The war is over. That's what he said, go back to your business. We've buried the dead and the war is over. Fatherless children have taken the street. All that remains is the sting of defeat. Homes are in ruins, cancer is rife. For soldiers and newborns, the end of a life. Kids grown up with just hunger and fear. But lo, behold, the Yankees are here. Now all you people are gonna be free. Cause this land was made for Chevron and me. And the war is over. That's what he said, just turn on your TV. We've buried the dead and the war is over. The government files are all up in flames. His victims of torture, who remembers their names? The past doesn't matter, but the future is bright as the Exxon refinery lights up the night. History's looted like the library's shelves, but we'll fill them with Bibles. Be proud of ourselves. Turn your schools into compounds. Make room for us all. If you're missing your legs, you can learn how to crawl. The war is over. That's what he said, forget it all happened. We've buried the dead and the war is over. And the price was worth it, yeah, we do it again. With bombs or with sanctions, kids, women, and men. Cause we have national interests and they must be met. We will enforce them by treaty or jet. And when time has passed and we've had some rest, we'll find a new villain, cause that's what we do best. Maybe a sultan or a grandson of Mao, but don't trouble your conscience, because as of now, the war is over. That's what he said, just put it behind you. We've buried the dead and the war is over.
Yes, indeed, the war is over and we're back and glad to be back with you. I went a little overtime on that one call we had there. That's what I get for not paying attention. Anyway, as I promised you, we have Mike Blake on the line today. He is a member of a Veterans Against the War group. And, Mike, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Got a little interference on the line here someplace. I don't know which end that's on, but we're hearing you just fine nonetheless.
Okay.
You are a vet of the Iraq War.
Yes, I'm a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, and I spent a year in Iraq.
I am fond of calling it the Bush War here on this program. I almost always do because I don't think there's any reason to call it anything else since it was totally and completely his. But why, after being a veteran in that conflict, why are you in this organization that has now come out against the war?
Well, during my tour in Iraq, I saw a lot of things that led me to believe that that our policies there were ineffective, that we were breeding terrorism rather than fighting it by a lot of the things we do, such as indiscriminate killings of civilians and destruction of private property, running over Iraqi vehicles with tanks, destroying houses, just basically having no regard for their personal property or their rights as human beings. And so after seeing and experiencing a lot of this, I decided that I couldn't participate in it anymore in good conscience. And once I got back to the States, I applied for conscientious objector discharge, and that's how I ended up getting out.
Mike, where's the leadership when this sort of thing is going on? I have to tell you, we got a letter from somebody who's there right now, maybe a couple of weeks ago, a gentleman that was stationed in Mosul, and told me that, and I hate to repeat this, but I mean, he told me that he had seen instances of our soldiers and some of the
Black Hawk.
Yeah, shoot at or actually shoot Iraqis for fun.
Right. I can't say that I witnessed any of those atrocities personally. However, I have several close friends in my unit who were with me who related those experiences to me and basically told me that kind of thing happens every day.
Certainly not a way to win friends and influence people in a foreign land.
Yeah, it's not exactly winning hearts and minds either.
No. Yeah. This latest story to come out, it's been evidently fermenting for nearly 6 months now.
Right.
Is it a total breakdown in command? What's the problem here? What's happening?
Well, I think what's happening is the chain of command is allowing these types of atrocities to occur in two ways. Either they are explicitly ordering these kinds of things to occur, or they are simply turning a blind eye when these things occur and sort of unofficially allowing it. But either way, ultimately, it's the chain of command who's responsible for these type of incidences, not the individual soldiers or Marines. They are the ones who actually commit the acts, yes, but they are always under orders from somebody. You know, a soldier doesn't do anything unless he's told to do it. And what's going on is when a lot of these instances get investigated, it's the lower level soldiers, the lowest ranking soldiers, who end up getting in trouble for it, and even low level officers like captains or lieutenants don't get in trouble for it. Let alone the colonels and generals and the Secretary of Defense, who are actually ultimately responsible for where these orders are coming from.
Well, it doesn't seem like the buck really stops on anybody's desk. I mean, we had the Abu Ghraib thing happen, and a couple low-level people end up going to prison, but that was the end of it. The rest of it was covered over nicely, and we didn't hear anything about it. And from what I understand, we never did hear the worst of it.
Right. I think one of the important things that people need to know about Haditha and incidences like it is that they're not isolated incidences. It's part of a larger systematic problem that's going on in Iraq. Innocent civilians are killed there every day at a much higher rate than service members are killed there. But the thing is that it doesn't get reported. For several reasons, one of which, the corporate media is essentially in the pocket of the Bush administration, and it's in their vested interest not to report it. Another major reason is that most of Iraq is so dangerous and uncontrolled security-wise that the majority of reporters never leave the green zone in Baghdad. They mostly stay there under protection. And a lot of those reporters who do leave end up getting killed. I think it's been around 100 journalists or so that have been killed in Iraq since the conflict began. So it's very dangerous out there, and that's one of the reasons why the journalists don't go out and actually get the real story. So the result of that is the Pentagon gives them the specific line of what's going on, and the press sort of swallows it, hook, line, and sinker, and feeds it to the American public, and that's where everybody's getting their news.
Well, you know, it was toward the first of the year when they had this, the Pentagon had this concentrated campaign about how the press was not doing their job and how all they ever reported was the bad news, and they didn't report on the plethora of good news that was coming from Iraq. Do you see that much good news coming from Iraq?
I think that that's completely false. I think that's part of the larger sort of campaign to move the entire political spectrum and the entire media to the right, with the, you know, with the creation of networks like Fox News, which is actually incredibly far to the right, but spends millions of dollars to try to convince people that it's somehow fair and balanced, and therefore becomes part of the so-called mainstream. And then networks like CNN, who are obviously controlled by corporate interests, are known as liberal when they even mention a single story that's against the administration's line. So basically, the entire mainstream media is sort of cowed into following the administration's line. And I don't think the mainstream media is liberal at all. I think actually they're pretty far to the right, because they're all sort of controlled by corporate interests who have a vested interest in the status quo in Iraq, because they're setting up Iraq right now as sort of a corporate safe haven with very low corporate taxes. And it's very easy for corporations like Halliburton and Bechtel to go there and earn billions of dollars in this new sort of corporate-friendly country that we have.
Sure. Well, there's going to be many products and services needed in that country. And,
absolutely.
The American countries are given the heads up on the whole thing. Several things I want to ask you about in this short amount of time that we have. Number one, I see we sent 1,500 more troops in day before yesterday.
Right.
And we heard all this talk about standing down when they stand up. This training that we've heard about of the Iraqi army and the Iraqi police force, is it legit?
I'm speaking of the perspective of my tour when I was there. I was there April 2003 to March 2004. So it was the first year-long tour. And when we were there, the training of Iraqi security forces was an absolute joke. We didn't have the time or the equipment to train them properly. The majority of the time when they came into action, they would disperse, they would desert, they would run away. What would also happen a lot of time is whenever our forces weren't around to sort of back them up, they disintegrated, essentially. And I can't really blame them, because we're sort of we're recruiting them, and the only reason why they're taking these jobs is because there is no jobs in the country, and they're the only jobs that, you know, pay anything. So they're taking these jobs, and essentially what they're doing is they're fighting their friends and neighbors. And it's extremely unpopular, and it's extremely dangerous for them. It puts their families at risk and themselves.
Sure.
And so what's sort of going on there is there's a big sort of public relations thing saying we're training this many police and this many army and this many so-and-so, but that doesn't amount to anything when those security forces are completely ineffective.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about a couple of very uncomfortable subjects, and it's uncomfortable for me to ask, and I hope it's not too uncomfortable for you. We got a letter from a vet who's over there right now, the same gentleman I was telling you about that was stationed in Mosul, and then he sent us a letter from another place, telling me that nearly everybody in his outfit, and by the way, all of them were there for the second and third tour, said nearly everybody in his outfit was carrying around a pocket full of Valium. Is it that prolific? I'm starting to hear stories of prescription medicine. I'm not talking about abuse by the guys, but I'm talking about the service actually saying, here, take this, and it's going to make your life better here if you've got any kind of post-traumatic stress syndrome or so forth.
Well, I'm not all that surprised by it. That wasn't a very prevalent thing in my unit during my tour. However, you know, the Army is very well known for giving out large amounts of painkillers and medications that sort of bring you into line and, you know, keep you with the mission and kill your pain for the time being, instead of actually solving the base of the problem, which would be your injury or your psychological injury. As far as, you know, issuing it to soldiers to have them, abuse them. I can't say I have all that much firsthand experience with it. Then again, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised by it.
Yes. Well, I've got a story I'm going to do on it later on in the program today, mm-hmm. a big old long story about guys who have been prescribed Zoloft and all sorts of things to...
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm not... Well, when soldiers get back to the States, you know, and they get out and they're there, you know, as veterans, or they're done with their tour or whatever, I have a lot of experience. This has happened to me and a lot of my friends, is that they overly medicate guys once they're out. With antidepressants and Valium and Zoloft and so forth, and basically just keep them stoned all the time rather than trying to solve their psychological problems. That happens a lot.
Post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Right.
Big thing.
Post-traumatic stress syndrome is something that affects the majority of veterans, I would say. I think that everyone in our organization deals with post-traumatic stress syndrome to some extent. I myself am on 30% disability of it for that right now. And the symptoms of that can range from anything to, you know, the reoccurring nightmares to hypervigilance. You're always looking around. You always need to sit with your back to a wall. You have anxiety, sort of a feeling of impending doom all the time. You can drive down the road, and something that the insurgents used to do is string up bombs by the side of the road, IEDs. And so when you get back to the States, what happens with a lot of guys, including myself, is that whenever you see something by the side of the road, you always tend to sort of steer around it or steer away from it. Mm. And I was a Humvee driver there, and I noticed how my driving is greatly affected by it. I'm a very defensive driver now, and I often do, you know, risky things when I'm in the car, and people say, you know, what's going on or whatever, and it's hard to explain to people.
Man, oh man, and you know, you hear about the horrors that happened in Haditha, and some of the guys that saw the aftermath of it, some of the scenes that I've seen described would live in your mind forever and ever, and I don't know how you'd ever get them out. I don't.
Yeah.
Some of the scenes with the children that we heard about.
Well, I mean, even something happened to me. You know, it was terrible. It was just yesterday. I went to the bank to cash a check, and on TV was CNN, and there was Bush saying, this is obviously an isolated incident, and these are a few bad apples, and la-da-da, just the same standard line that he always gives. And then they had pictures of bodies, and, you know, body parts from Haditha, and I think it's important for the American people to see that, to see the reality of it.
But, absolutely.
Just speaking from a personal viewpoint, as a veteran, having seen bodies before, I was, you know, very, very, very upset by it and very disturbed. And you know, that happens. You know, there will be little triggers like a movie or a video game or something like that that can just totally,
oh man,
totally bring you back.
Well, Mike, I'm thankful for your service, and I'm glad you got home okay. And I'm also thankful that you're in this group, Iraq Veterans Against the War. Give us your website, please.
Yeah, our website is ivaw.net. Okay, and if you go to our website, you can send us emails. You can hear about the events that we're doing. And I recommend that for any Iraq veterans who are listening or who know Iraq veterans to please get on our website and get connected with us, because we're always looking for new members. And you know, beyond all the anti-war activities that we do, we also provide sort of a veteran community for everyone, you know, who's been coming out of this Iraq war, and providing sort of a safe haven where you can talk about PTSD and issues that you're dealing with in your life with other veterans who understand what you're going through. And there's a real sense of community that we have in our organization. You know, it's not just protest marches and speakouts that we do.
Sure.
So, you know, spend time together, and we counsel each other, and you know, we try to be there for each other, you know, when things get rough.
I've made the statement on this program that if everybody had to see probably things that you've seen, if everybody had to see the aftermath of Haditha, if they had to see some of the horrors that you've seen and your buddies have seen, that this war would probably be over with in short order. Do you agree?
Absolutely, absolutely. You will very rarely find an actual combat veteran, a veteran who has been shot at and who has taken lives, who will ardently support war. That is a very rare thing. I mean, they're very few and far between because, well, there's some sick people out there, and I've seen it myself. But by and large, men and women who have seen combat feel as though no one should ever have to go through what they went through and see what they saw. And that nothing, you know, there's nothing that can justify that kind of violence. And it really, you know, it just changes everything when you see it for yourself. And then you're never the same after that. And no matter how hard you try to be the same as everyone else, you realize that you're not. And that's why it's important that us veterans are there for each other, to support each other, and let, you know, everybody else know that, you know, they're not alone, basically, and there's people who understand.
Absolutely. Mike, thanks so much for being on. But give us the website one more time, please.
The website is IVAW, that's as in Iraq Veterans Against War, .net.
Okay. It's a good site. I've been there, and folks, you will enjoy it, and it's very informative. Mike, thanks so much for being on the Guy James Show today. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Bye.
There are many, many stories like his. Many thousands of stories like his. And I had somebody send me an article that I wonder, I can't believe that anybody could write something like this, and especially after listening to Mike, how could anybody write something like this? A right-winger columnist wrote, "There is one aspect about Haditha that seems to be ignored by everybody. Our press and the anti-American left, both in this country and outside of it, has been reporting Hadithas over and over again over the last 3 years. Time and again, our friends have accused us of every possible atrocity that there is, to the point that internationally, people are all already able to believe this, or the 9/11 stuff, or all the rest." Yeah. He goes on to say, "Because of this, internationally, it is totally irrelevant if the Marines actually violated the rules of war. Our foes are going to say we've done things if we do them or not. So the only people that it really matters to will be the people killed in their families and the people in our own country who support the military. These are the only people that this matters to. The real danger is what we who support the war will reach the point that we say we might as well be taken as wolves than as sheep. At that point, the left can celebrate that they have made our military and those who support it the people they claim we are. Once that happens, however, any compunction about respecting them will be gone. And remember, one side is armed and one is not." So, by a right-wing columnist named Peter Njemi. I guess you don't have to say any more about the problem when you read something like that. If you've got a mindset like that, and obviously there are people in command in our military right now who have mindsets like that. To me, it's obvious that there are people all the way at the top that have mindsets like that. That's a tragedy. That's not a tragedy just for the people that died in Haditha. That's not a tragedy just for the soldiers that died there. That's a tragedy for America. And when America suffers a tragedy, the world suffers a tragedy. This isn't a localized thing. We need to remember that. We do. Well, we're going to take a break at the top of the hour for the news. Hope you'll stick around. We've got a lot to talk about in the second hour of the program. Don't go away. We'll be back right after the news.
This is Quality News Network. The Army Corps of Engineers says Louisiana's hurricane system is over 6,000-page document released today includes details on engineering and design failures that led to the levee failures in New Orleans. This is the first day of hurricane season, but if this year is anything like every year since 1855, the Gulf shouldn't see many hurricanes for the next month or so. In more than 150 years, not a single hurricane and only four tropical storms have come near New Orleans in the month of June. The Iraqi government says it will conduct its own investigation into reports that U.S. Marines killed unarmed civilians last year in Haditha. The Wall Street Journal reports that one of the two U.S. military investigations into the Haditha killings will conclude that some Marine officers gave false reports to their superiors, who then failed to scrutinize the information. Meanwhile, the U.S. general in Iraq has ordered American commanders to conduct ethical training on battlefield conduct. And still another investigation now underway in Iraq in connection with the deaths of two women, one of them pregnant, who were en route to a hospital in Baghdad when U.S. forces fired on their car. Iran has rejected Washington's conditional offer for direct talks about its nuclear program. Iran says it is open to discussions, but not with a precondition that it stop enriching uranium, which it claims it has a natural right to do. North Korea is inviting the chief U.S. envoy to that country for nuclear talks if Washington proves it is committed to an agreement that offers North Korea concessions for abandoning its nuclear program. The head of Afghan's highway police says he saw U.S. soldiers fire into an angry crowd, killing three people as their convoy was leaving the scene of an accident which triggered anti-U.S. riots earlier this week. Afghan's parliament has called for the U.S. soldiers involved in the accident and Afghans who led the riots to be prosecuted under Afghan law. International relief teams have yet to reach remote areas of Indonesia's quake zone, where newly reported deaths from last weekend's disaster have raised the toll to more than 6,200. East Timor's president is pleading with the country's feuding security forces to show national unity. More than 2,200 foreign peacekeepers are now in that country to help quell the violence. Another glitch in the immigration debate. Tens of thousands of Nicaraguans and Hondurans legally here since 1998 as part of a program to help victims of Hurricane Mitch will lose their legal status today and face deportation unless they renew their temporary work permits. The government says nearly half of them, 40,000, failed to do so, likely because they're under the mistaken belief they will soon be on the path of becoming U.S. citizens. It's 2.5 minutes past the hour.
Divorce is never a pleasant experience, but it doesn't have to be a tragedy. If you can rein in the emotions, step back from the anger and victimhood, you can end your marriage with dignity instead of hostility. You married with the best of intentions. Now you need to untie the marital knot with the same mutual respect. Choose collaboration instead of confrontation. Stop wasting money on lawyers. Don't drag this out for 5 years. A collaborative divorce is better for the children, family, and friends. Collaboration costs a fraction of a contended divorce and can be done within weeks rather than the months or years. An award-winning documentary called Divorce Collaborative Style explains how you can end your marriage fairly and efficiently. For less than what a lawyer charges to answer one simple question, you can get all the answers from Divorce Collaborative Style. Go to collaborativedivorce.tv and order your DVD today. If it's over, end it right. collaborativedivorce.tv.
Initial claims for unemployment benefits rose last week to the highest level since October. The Labor Department says that first-time claims rose by 7,000 to 336,000 in the week ending May 27th. The Labor Department also says that productivity, the key factor in rising living standards, rose at an annual rate of 3.7% in the January-March quarter. That's better than the 3.2% initially estimated a month ago. Many of the nation's big chain retail stores are reporting better-than-expected sales results for May. Ford and Chrysler reporting a lower U.S. sales in May as higher gas prices cut into demand for big fuel-thirsty SUVs and pickup trucks. For the first time in 10 months, construction spending unexpectedly dipped 0.1% in April due to a sharp drop in outlays on residential building. OPEC today prepared to leave oil supply quotas unchanged and keep pumping at full capacity, rejecting a push for a production cut by host Venezuela, the cartel's leading price hawk. A bankruptcy judge has okayed a deal in which Delta Airlines pilots agreed to $280 million in concessions. That approval came despite an objection by the government's pension insurer. And Walmart says it may offer ethanol made from corn at its 383 U.S. gas stations, but is not yet ready to make any announcements in that regard. Light sweet crude oil today trading at this hour $71.05 a barrel. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials are up 46, NASDAQ is up 21, and the S&P 500 is higher by 9. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Diana Walter. It's now 5 minutes past the hour.
¶¶ your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Ah, yes. Here we are back from the news, all refreshed. Had a cold drink and look outside, and everything seems to be all in order. Glad to have you along back along with us. I was reminded, I caught up on my email such as I could during the break. And our good friends John and Carolyn Ostojic from here in Florida reminded me that summer does indeed start the 21st of June at 8:26 a.m. Now, that's being precise. 8:26 a.m., summer officially starts this year here. So, good. Very good. And thank you. And thank you. They're good supporters of the show, and I appreciate that so very, very much. I was looking at the news, and so now Condi Rice agrees to talk to Iran. I saw that headline, and I thought, my. The only thing is that in order for us to, she's telling Iran, for, you know, the only thing for us to, you know, in order for us to talk to you, you have to agree to give in to our demands, which is what is causing this need for a little talk in the first place. And about then your head would go spinning, wouldn't it? Am I getting this right? We're having an argument. It needs to be settled. Let's talk about it and see if we can come to an agreement. But before we talk, you have to agree that I am right, and you will agree to do what I ask you to do in the first place before we have our talk, okay? That's actually how much sense this makes. So Iran wants to talk to us, and the U.S. says no, 1,000 times no, but the world community thinks our attitude is foolish and arrogant, so we agree to talk if Iran will do what we wanted them to do in the first place. Here's what I want to ask Condi. And I don't know that I'll get the chance to, but if I did, if I run into her in Washington, you know, at the local cafe or something, if the Iranians agree to our demands, what in the hell do we need to talk to them about then? I mean, what are you going to talk about? And why would they be stupid enough to talk to us under those circumstances? Oh, I see. You're doing all of this just so you can go in front of the public. I get it. You can go in front of the public and say, "See, we tried to talk to them, but they don't want to cooperate." That's the game, isn't it, Condi? Of course it is. Absolutely. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said the U.S. would join the EU nations in talks if Iran suspended uranium enrichment and reprocessing work. I got to tell you, Condi, if Ahmadinejad falls for that one, tell him to call me because I've got some waterfront property in Sparks, Nevada that I'd like to sell him at a terrific price. But, oh, wait, the Iranians didn't fall for that stupid game. The Iranian state news agency dismissed the offer as, quote, a propaganda move. I wonder where they ever got that idea. Now, Junior Bush, being the eternal optimist that he is, says he believes the issue can be solved diplomatically. I'm sorry. When that man says that word, that my antenna goes up. I would submit to you that when he says that, Junior Bush is an effing liar. And if he thought that the time to have been talking, you know, if he thought that, the time to have been talking was months, if not years ago. The New York Times printed an article saying that this was an offer intended to fail so as to show Iran to be uncooperative. Gee, you don't really think the Bush administration would pull a stunt like that, do you? Oh, you're too much of a cynic. You shouldn't think naughty things like that about the Bush administration. I certainly never would. Oh, what else did we have on our list today? I had several veterans things I wanted to talk about. And after talking to Mike, I tell you, there are things going on in Iraq that are so troublesome. So troublesome. You know, we told you a long time ago, what was it, about a month ago, when we talked on the story about the story that the current deployed Army sergeant in Iraq sent us, he sent us an email, and we read it on the air, and he was telling us about the meds that a lot of people are taking just to stay sane. These are people that are deployed, not home. They're deployed. They're there right now. He spoke of people carrying around vials of Valium so they could get through the day, get through the night. Man, that scares me, people walking around with weapons. And I'm not blaming them. The military told Congress that medications aren't used to keep soldiers with serious mental illness in combat. That's what the military told Congress. But there's every indication that drugs are increasingly being handed out. First class, I don't know if I should give the name here. Let's just say Army Sergeant First Class Mark was diagnosed with depression soon after his deployment to Iraq. A military doctor handed him a supply of mood-altering drug Effexor right after he got there. Marine PFC Robert Allen, and that was his first name and middle name, was given Zoloft to relieve the depression he developed in Iraq. And Army PFC Melissa Hobart was dutifully taking the Celexia. I don't even know what some of these are. Celexa. She was prescribed to ease the anxiety of being separated from her young daughter while in Baghdad. Oh, God, I didn't read all this close enough. Oh, my God. All three were given antidepressants to help them make it through their tours of duty in Iraq. All three of them came home in coffins. Warren was 44. Guy was 26. Committed suicide last year, according to the military. Hobart, 22, collapsed in June 2004 of a still undetermined cause. The three are among a growing number of mentally troubled service members who are being kept in combat and treated with potent psychotropic medications. A little examined practice driven in part by a need to maintain troop strength, because the Iraqi troops are standing up so well and we're able to stand down, right? Interviews with troops, families, and medical experts, as well as autopsy and investigative reports obtained, reveal that the emphasis on retention has had dangerous and sometimes tragic consequences. Antidepressant medications with potentially serious side effects are being dispensed with little or no monitoring and sometimes minimal counseling, despite FDA warnings that the drugs can increase suicidal thoughts. Military doctors treating combat stress symptoms are sending some soldiers back to the front lines after rest and a three-day regimen of drugs, even though experts say the drugs typically take 2 to 6 weeks to begin working. The emphasis on maintaining troop numbers has led some military doctors to misjudge the severity of mental health symptoms. Some of the practices are at odds with the military's own medical guidelines, which state that certain mental illnesses are incompatible with military service, and some medications are not suited for combat deployment. This is terrible. I mean, this is really, really terrible. These practices conflict with statements by your top military health officials who have indicated to Congress that psychiatric drugs are not being used to keep service members with serious disorders in combat. In an interview Monday, Army Surgeon General Lieutenant Kevin C. Kiley insisted that the military uses psychiatric medications cautiously in the war zone, saying that medical professionals may prescribe them at low doses for very mild symptoms that might assist soldiers in transitioning through an event. He said the emphasis on keeping troubled troops close to the front line is in the service members' best interest. Oh, I'll bet it is. Because it helps them recover and avoid the stigma of abandoning their duty. That's the old deal. If you fall off the horse, get right back on it again, even if you broke your leg, right? But there are a lot of people outside of the chain of that command that see this a whole lot differently. It's best for the Army, said Paul Rickhoff, a former platoon leader in Iraq who said he was overruled when he tried to have a mentally ill soldier evacuated. But find me an independent mental health expert who thinks that's a proper course of action. It's just plain dehumanizing. They're denying these guys a humane treatment, and that humane treatment would be to get out of the battle. The best therapy for someone in that kind of stress is to get them out of the stress. The worst thing is to add a drug to it. You've still got the stress. You're still in the situation, and then we add the drug to it. That's unconscionable. It's absolutely unconscionable. But we've got to keep them in there, don't we? To hear Mr. Rumsfeld's talk. Tell it, we have plenty of soldiers. And if we do, if we've got all these soldiers to spare that Mr. Rumsfeld likes to brag about, why is it? Why is it that we're keeping people deployed in Iraq with these kinds of problems? Why is it they can't send them home? If we've got all these spare soldiers sitting around not doing anything like Donald Rumsfeld would have you believe. Why is that? I'll tell you why that is, because Rumsfeld is a damn liar. That's exactly why that is. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hi, this is Juanita.
Hi, Juanita.
I'd like to relay my soul bare for a moment or two.
You may.
I've had mental illness all my life. I guess I was born with it. And I take Zoloft now. It helps me. But everybody cannot take it. You cannot hand out this kind of medication willy-nilly. I've taken some medicines that made me want to kill myself.
Mm.
Some that even told me that I had to kill myself because I owed money. You know, just...
Wow.
And I've had some make my blood pressure go down so low till I be at the point of death. And they finally found that Zoloft works for me. But it doesn't work for everybody. Everybody is individual, and this is just horrible, horrible. It's just despicable, and it, you know, what you said yesterday, and then I heard Randy Rhodes last night. She was so upset, and I'm telling you, what are we going to do, Guy? What are we going to do?
I don't know. Imagine having this problem.
Imagine being in war, or having the problems that I've had.
Yeah, and then hand you a high-powered rifle. Hand you a high-powered rifle with plenty of ammunition and some grenades to go along with it.
Medications should be given out only by qualified psychiatrists. They shouldn't even be given out by a GP or anything like that. They are.
And then sending these kids back to the front line.
To me, I just think God is getting disgusted, and I wouldn't want to be in their shoes for all the tea in China.
Well,
for all the money that they're loving to make.
Yeah.
And that's all it is, the love of money, and that's it, and the power. They don't care about anybody. And I've been watching. I used to watch when Rumsfeld would be up, and they would tell him that our soldiers don't have... the armor that they need.
Right.
This was like after it first started.
Right.
I watched a lot of those, and he'd sit there, really, really, really?
Mm-hmm.
And then also that, the other one, one of the other, not Pearl, but the other one that,
Wolfowitz.
Yeah, Wolfowitz. They tell him, and he'd act like, really?
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know that. You know, that's the way their attitude was. And there's never nothing, 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 nothing.
Well, that's their jobs to know these sorts of things, and they didn't know them, and they were derelict in their duty, as far as I'm concerned.
What are we going to do, Guy? We've got, like you said yesterday,
well,
something's got to give.
It does, and I do believe, and this young man we talked to a while ago, I do believe that if every American had to see the horrors, the pictures of what took place in that Haditha massacre, I think this war would be over with real quick. I really do.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are some that wouldn't bother.
It's horrible for our people. It's horrible for their people. My God.
Yeah.
You know, the ambassador to the United States from over there, he said one of his nephews, they just went in and killed him.
Yeah, yeah.
And you got Rush Limbaugh. Oh, that's not nothing but college pranks.
Yeah.
I think that guy has got as much to do with corrupting the people's minds in this country as anybody.
Oh, and there is no question about it. He's number one. He's the reason George Bush is in the White House right now. He is the reason.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you, guys.
Hey, thanks for your call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yeah, you want a reason why this guy's in office? I know some of you won't agree with me. I know you won't agree with me. But I know some of you will. I mean, we can take a look at the voting machines, and we know the story on that. And we can take a look at this, and we can take a look at that. But if you want to put it in somebody's lap, how George W. Bush got in office, take a look at Rush Limbaugh. There it is. There's the master of propaganda right there. There's a man who has convinced millions of people to vote for George W. Bush. There's a man who has no soul. There's a man who said that we should lock up everybody who's on drugs and throw away the key. Then we find out he lost his own hearing because of an overdose of hallucinogenic drugs. Painkillers, I guess. Oxycontin. Hydrocodone. What a hypocrite. They're all hypocrites. But if you want to lay this problem at the feet of a gentleman, just I take that back. I didn't mean to say gentleman. He's no gentleman. But there's a guy that has propagandized half of America for money, for $30, $35 million a year. How much conscience do you have if you'll do that? How much conscience do you have if you'll go in front of the public every day and try and get somebody elected and stand behind everything they do, and mention that the Abu Ghraib thing was a college prank and all that? What kind of a conscience do you have? What kind of a human being are you when you know it's wrong and you'll stand there and defend it anyway? What kind of a man are you? Oh, don't get me started on that subject. Don't get me started on that subject. I just thought it was interesting to bring this up about the drugs that are going on over there. We've heard it firsthand from a soldier that's stationed over there. We're seeing suicides from people on Zoloft over there. We're seeing him give them Zoloft and the sleep aid Ambien. Jeez. This is the drug where people actually get up and sleepwalk at night, and they're giving it. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. I read these stories. I've got a whole stack of these in front of me. I do. I've got a whole stack of these stories about prescription medication being handed out to anybody, you know. Here, take this. Take this. You saw something horrible happen last night. Well, take your gun and get back out there. But here's a pack of Zoloft. You take this and you'll feel better in the morning. These people in that condition need to be brought home. First of all, they all need to be brought home. Not 6 months from now, not a year from now, They need to be brought home tomorrow. They need to start up the planes and fly over there and get them now. And there's an email being passed around today, and I know a lot of you have seen it, and I've gotten it a half a dozen times, and I want to thank all my friends who send me those anyway. I do sort through and look at each and every email, even the ones that they signed me. I won that UK lottery four times today, I'll have you know. And I've got some Nigerian gentlemen wanting to help me transfer $50 million over here. So, you know, there's some good money-making opportunities on the Internet as well. But I will not, and it's in this can't talk today. It's in this email being passed around today from the Code Pink people about not backing anybody who backs the war. And I've made that pledge a long, long time ago on this program, a long time ago, that I will not, under any circumstances, back any Democratic candidate for presidency of the United States who, A, voted for the war, or B, voted for the war and doesn't say they're sorry that they were wrong and we've got to end it now. I will not break that vow under any circumstances. I cannot, in good conscience, vote for anybody who still thinks that war is okay. Do you hear me, Hillary? Do you hear me? Did you see the I'm not here. Yeah, well, maybe I am. This is my show. I guess I can say what I want to say on it. I don't want to offend anybody, but if I had to pick somebody to run right now, you full well know it would be Al Gore. You know that. I respect John Kerry tremendously. I think he's a great human being. I do. And I like Hillary Clinton. I've met Hillary Clinton. I've talked to Hillary Clinton. I like her. Did you see one of her main advisors on with Tweety Bird yesterday doing the dance? Tweety Bird kept saying, well, what's her position on the war? Well, you know, that's a very complicated issue. And what's her position on the war? Does she have a plan to end the war? What's the plan? The guy says, well, you know, that's above my pay grade. And Tweety Bird says, no, it's not above your pay grade. You're her top advisor. I want to know, well, you know, I'm just a domestic. No. You know what her thoughts are on the war. Tell us what they are. And he refused. He did the dance. He did the nice little politicking dance. And I'm not going to take that from any politician. And I hope you won't either. I hope that no matter who you consider for the presidency of the United States, I hope that you will demand that they be honest and forthright and right up front with you. I hope that above all, I know that we will not all agree with each of our politicians all the time. Fair enough. Nobody agrees 100% of the time. But anybody that you cast your precious vote for should be required to tell you the truth about what their plans are for this war, knowing full well that the war is the number one issue in the hearts and minds of American voters right now. They must tell the truth on that. And I mean it. I've said it a dozen times, and I'll repeat it. I will not back any Democratic candidate who, A, voted for the war, or B, voted for the war, or maybe didn't even vote for the war. That would be even better. And doesn't say they're sorry, say they were wrong, and that it needs to end now. I will not back anybody. You will not hear me change my mind on that under any circumstances whatsoever. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a minute. Don't go anywhere.
On the last Fourth Estate, we heard from Robert Fisk.
What has now become a habit of compromising on the semantics of reporting in order to avoid criticism. You know, if you call a Jewish settlement or neighborhood a colony, you'll be criticized and called potentially anti-Semitic.
And a little bit of activist history and the Red Scare.
On the line with us right now, we have Kate Fossil, biographer of Ann Braden.
You know, I got interested in Ann's life because of her being being a white Southern voice against racism. And
leave it to our listeners to ring up and keep it light.
I don't either. And, you know, Bruce is concerned about the remote control for his DVD player. I mean, I'm thinking about getting rid of the remote control on my blow-up doll. I mean, you know.
What's his name?
I never kiss and tell.
WorthEstateRadio.com. It's an all-night thing.
Okay, listen up. If you're sick of hearing lies by right-wing corporate pukes who like to pretend they stand up for the working guy, then head over to the Cup of Joe radio show where the truth will hit you so hard you'll have to wear your hard hat. You can listen to the screaming audio at cupojoe.blogspot.com. That's cupojoe.blogspot.com. Now get back to work.
Okay, we're back, and about a half hour to go in the program. That's about it. Where does the time go? I don't know where it goes. It gets away from me every single day. Hey, let's go to the phone. We've got Robert in Florida. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Guy. I'm a fairly long-time listener. I have to work in the afternoons. I never get to see hear your show live, as it were, but come home, download the MP3, and listen to it in the evenings.
Well, good. Thank you.
And really enjoy it. Really enjoy your insight. I have something to add, though. I have a slow day today, so I'm at home, so I'm actually listening to your show live. I have something to add to your requirement for a Democratic candidate for president to get my vote. And
yes, I'm interested.
In addition to the two that you stated, either A, have been against the war from the beginning, and that's the preferable position, or you say they voted for the war, but then recanted, changed their mind, said they were sorry. Well, to me, that kind of comes down to a question of basic competence. If a Democratic candidate voted for the war, when millions of ordinary Americans, such as myself, could see from the beginning that this was a whitewash, this was fairy tale excuses to get us into this war. The reason du jour for the war changed every day.
Yes.
And it was never the real reason. We never heard that.
No.
Now, if our politicians, if their position is that, oh, I'm sorry, I was fooled by the Bush administration. Well, I'm sorry, that's still not good enough for me.
Well, you know, Robert, I'm most certainly inclined to agree with you. I've said that before. If laymen like you and I are out here and we weren't fooled, why were you fooled? And I've had a couple of them tell me to my face, the stuff they showed us was so convincing. Well, granted, you and I here in Florida didn't see what maybe our congressman saw, but it still smelled to high heaven. And I would think before you cast a vote on the war that further investigation would have been in order. But a lot of these people just didn't do that.
And that's the crux of that issue there. For when we have a representative in Washington, if we have our president who's supposed to represent us, if they can't grasp that, I mean, like I said, it comes down to basic issues of competency.
All right, so I have to ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, this is not a trick question, Bob. As you know, that narrows the field considerably, does it not?
Yes, it does.
Really,
it
does. Really narrow.
It does indeed.
Then you're talking Dennis Kucinich.
Yep, you're talking Dennis. You're still talking L, though, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right.
So.
Okay, I just wanted to find out there. I love both of those guys. Did you get a chance to see Kucinich when he was here a couple of months? Oh, I guess it's been about 3 months.
I did not.
Oh,
he was. I regretted that. The initial, what was it? We had nine Democratic candidates vying for the nomination in 2004.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Well, Dennis was was right at the top there in my book.
Yeah, Dennis Kucinich is the real deal. Anybody that doubts, yeah, he's everything that they say he is. He's eccentric. I don't know of politicians that's got more eccentricities than he does, but he is a absolute delightful human being to be with. We he came to that little soiree we had down at the Bonita Club in Bonita Springs at the school there, and spent as much time as anybody wanted him to spend. He would have stayed there all night and answered every question by anybody was there. It was the nicest gathering with a pal that I think I've ever seen. I had met him before, but never had the chance to really engage him like we did that night. And what a wonderful guy he is. I just love him.
Every time I've heard him speak, he comes across as a man of conviction and authenticity.
Oh, yeah.
Talk about narrowing the field.
In spades. And I like what I'm hearing from Al Gore right now. I do.
I borrowed his book from a friend, Earth in the Balance, many years ago, during the Bush senior years. And as I finished that book, I closed the book and I said to myself, man, this guy needs to be our president.
Sure. Sure.
And then 2004 came along, and I was giddy with excitement.
Yeah. And you know, if there is such a thing as karma,
yeah,
Al Gore ought to be president. I mean, and you know, just to go a step further. Yeah, just to go a step further with what you said. If there's somebody that ought to be president, it'd be so good for America. It'd be good for the world.
Yeah.
It'd be so good for the world with his ideas on the environment. And you can see already how they're trying to demonize him over this. But we're not going to let him do it this time.
It'd be good for the economy as well.
That's right.
Just wanted to get my 2 cents in, guys.
Well, I'm glad you did, and a great 2 cents it was, more like a dime's worth. And I thank you so much for calling the program.
I will call back when I get a chance.
I hope you do.
I work afternoon, so I usually miss your show, but then I come home, download the MP3, and listen to it in the evenings, and then some issue will come up, and I really want to talk about you.
Well, you keep working. I'm glad you're still working. You're one of the lucky ones. Hey, thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
Bye now.
Bye.
What he said, it does narrow the field. It narrows it tremendously. It really does. And we Democrats have some real soul searching to do. We do. This is going to be difficult for a lot of people. Oh, you know how it is with some folks. I'll just vote for this guy or for that. There's so many people that don't do their homework. So many, and I'm sorry to say that, but it's true. It is true that so many people they don't do it. They just vote with whoever looks the best or whoever did the best in that debate last night. They see one debate or whatever, you know. Yeah, well. Somebody sent me a cute little list of funny things. At least I think they're funny. And I'll give you a couple of them here. I saw a woman wearing a sweatshirt with Guess. You know, the clothing company Guess. I saw a woman wearing a sweatshirt with Guess on it. So I said, implants? And she hit me. How come we choose from just two people to run for president and over 50 for Miss America? Now, there's a good one. When I was young, we used to go skinny dipping. Now I just chunky dunk. I love it. That's cute. What else? We got another one here we can say. I signed up for an exercise class and was told to wear loose-fitting clothing. If I had any loose-fitting clothing, I wouldn't have signed up in the first place. Oh, thank you, Carolyn. Thank you for sending those. Those are cute. I've got a story that's funny, but sadly true, that I'd like to read you. And it's about a gentleman by the name of... Well, let's go to the phone. I don't want anybody to make anybody wait. Well, no. The light's not flashing anymore. This is about a gentleman named David Rubenstein. And he was the co-founder and managing director of the Carlyle Group, the world's largest private equity firm. You know the Carlyle Group. I know just about every one of you know who the Carlyle Group is. Mm-hmm. And he told this story. And these are his words. And keep that in mind. These are his words. It's only take me a minute. And again, this is a quote from Mr. David Rubenstein, co-founder of the Carlyle Group. But when we were putting the board together, somebody, Fred Malik, I believe, came to me and said, look, there's a guy who would like to be on the board. He's kind of down on his luck a bit. He needs a job. He needs a board position. He needs some board positions. Could you put him on the board, pay him a salary, and he'll be a good board member and be a loyal vote for the management and so forth? And I said, well, we're not usually in that business, but okay, let me meet the guy. I met the guy. I said, I don't think he adds that much value, but we'll put him on the board because, well, you know, we'll do a favor for this guy. He's done a favor for us. So we put him on the board, and he spent 3 years, this is on the Carlyle board, mind you, came to all the meetings, told a lot of jokes, not very many clean ones. And after a while, I kind of said to him, after about 3 years, you know, I'm not sure this is really for you. Maybe you should do something else, because I don't think you're adding that much value to the board. You don't know that much about the company. And he said, well, I think I'm getting out of this business anyway, and I really don't like it that much, so I'm probably going to resign from the board. And Rubenstein said, and as said, thanks. I didn't think I'd ever see him again. His name is George W. Bush. He became president of the United States. So you know, if you said to me, name 25 million people who would maybe be president of the United States, he wouldn't have been in that category, so you never know. Anyway, I haven't been invited to the White House for anything. I think that's a great story. I'd heard it before. Maybe some of you have as well. But not smart enough to be on the board. They had to ask him to leave, and here he is leading the country. Well, I will say one thing. The Carlyle Group has done right well while the gentleman has been the president of the United States. That is a certainty. Gosh, we're seeing such bad news from Ohio. I did want to briefly mention that, being an ex-Buckeye, and to all of our listeners up in Ohio, and there are many. Tom Noe, the ex-coin dealer admits laundering Bush contributions, and he's sentenced to be up to 30 months. And the prosecutor said he'll seek more time. This is from the Toledo Blade. More than 2 years after investigators began probing Tom Noe's vaunted political fundraising ability, he admitted yesterday that he used friends and colleagues to illegally pour thousands of dollars into the effort to reelect President Bush. Noe, whose fundraising acumen earned him star status as a Bush pioneer, an exalted position to be sure, and helped him secure coveted federal and state political appointments, pleaded guilty to all three felony counts he faced. Wasn't he on the Turnpike Commission? I think. No, he said he wanted to spare, quote, my dear family and friends further embarrassment, unquote. The 51-year-old is facing between 24 and 30 months in prison and a substantial fine, according to federal sentencing guidelines, Assistant U.S. Attorney John Pearson said. However, he said he would seek an even stiffer penalty because of the potential loss of public faith in the presidential election. Now, this U.S. attorney, I don't know, but I'm guessing from that statement. I could be wrong, but I'm just guessing that, oh, this U.S. attorney might be a Republican, because he says Noe stealing millions of dollars might cause, and giving it to Bush, might cause a potential loss of public faith in the presidential election after all we know about what went wrong in the election in Ohio with the black box voting machines, a potential loss of public faith? Whoa. Okay. So anyway, that's what's happened with Noe up there. He raised more than hundreds of Bush pioneers and rangers. I'm not sure. He was a pioneer. I think to be a ranger, you had to raise $200,000. And so what he's saying is happening, and what happened. And gosh, you got to feel sorry for the poor guy. You really do. Well, first of all, he stole millions of dollars from two rare coin funds that he managed for the Ohio Bureau of Workmen's Compensation. They got a trial coming up for that one, too, so he's not off the hook. But what happened was to the poor guy, and again, you got to feel bad for him here, you really do, is he promised the Bush administration that he was going to raise a certain amount of money at... For this big night that they were going to have. He bought a table or something, the way they do at this big soiree. And a lot of his people backed out on him, said they either didn't want to give or they couldn't afford to give. The $2,000 apiece is what it was. So Noe thought, you know, I can't look bad to the Bush people, because he had pledged $50,000 for this campaign thing. And so when his friends claimed they couldn't attend the 2000 plate event or couldn't afford it, he thought, well, I'll just use my own money for their $2,000 tickets. But he'd already given the maximum contribution for a few months earlier, and he knows it's a naughty thing to do this, but he did it anyway, and he said he'd give his own money. Now, the only thing is, he said he was given his own money, and he's accused of stealing several million dollars from the Workmen's Compensation Fund, which he'll go on trial for in August. There's some bad boys out there in this Republican Party right now. Some real, real nasty boys. Also, I got a letter from a friend of ours, and this is from a West Point graduate, okay? A West Point grad, and it's a letter to Junior Bush. It's a public letter to Junior Bush from a West Point graduate. You know, Bush spoke there the other day, and it kind of riled up this gentleman. He said, "You must be corrected about this place, West Point. It's not a tin school. That's just a joke, and not one for either you or Rumsfeld to crack wise about. West Point is supposed to develop military leadership to provide expertise in the increasingly complex world of geopolitics. Rumsfeld's wishful thinking and arrogance swept all of that away. His and your tragically flawed, ego-driven ideology trumped empirical professional judgment and leadership. Over a score of generals walked rather than bow their necks under the deceitful yoke of Rumsfeld, and then you ended up with the likes of Tommy, we don't do body counts, Franks. But now he is counting bodies, those of our own troops. What we're talking about is neither 2,400, 24,000, or 240,000 lives, the dismissive Franks said at a recent NRA bash, adding, paradoxically, it... terrorism doesn't have anything to do with politics. Jeez, I'm going to be that stupid. And so the writer of the letter, the West Point graduate, says, "Does this make you feel proud, Mr. Bush, to have people like this develop policies for the United States of America? We pay attention to everything up here at West Point, Mr. Bush. Even the fact that you told the same joke about giving cadets amnesty that you told 4 years ago. You should be more respectful of West Point, Mr. Bush. That seems to be a pattern in your behavior, smackhead. Tell the same stories over and over, and you throw around names of old grads like Eisenhower and Bradley, using them to somehow justify what you and your big buddies in D.C. have done to the world. What do you know about Eisenhower or Bradley? You might get away with that stuff in the Oval Office, but not up here, not at West Point. The long gray line spans the generations, mister. Its spirit fills the geographic intellectual and moral space that is West Point. The old grads are always there. You never said anything about what those old grads said. You just got the cadets' attention by saying the words Eisenhower and Bradley. But then that was the idea, wasn't it? Then you launched into how President Truman did this, that, and the other thing. You even pulled a Winston Churchill with your never back down, never give in, never accept anything less than complete victory routine. It reminded many of us of that mission accomplished crud that you babbled off the coast of San Diego a few years ago. Just who are you, Mr. Bush? Makes cadets wonder whether there's anything inside that fine civilian suit of yours. Do you remember what you said here at the Academy 4 years ago about preemptive action? Do you know what Dwight Eisenhower said about that much earlier? Remember this? Eisenhower said, when people speak to you about a preventive war, you tell them to go and fight it. After my experience, I have come to hate war, and this fellow classmate from the class of 1915, the class the stars fell on over Omar Bradley, was even clearer. Omar Bradley, and I quote, said, "Wars can be prevented just as surely as they can be provoked, and we who fail to prevent them must share the guilt for the dead." You feel like sharing any of that responsibility, any of that guilt, Mr. Bush? Your decision, your deceit-filled decision to attack Iraq has cost tens of thousands of lives. What do you have to say about that? It seems to us that you have to watch your language, Mr. Bush. I mean, you still maintain that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and that he was somehow responsible for 9/11. Your evasions and quibbling and lies have cost the world dearly, and you implied as much again in your speech at West Point. On September 11, 2001, we saw that the problems originating in a failed and oppressive state 7,000 miles away could bring murder and destruction to our country. You said that. The writer goes on to say, 4 years ago, you were introduced to the graduating class of 2002 as a man who exemplifies the West Point motto of duty, honor, country. That now revolts some graduates of West Point. At West Point, we uphold the Cadet Honor Code. A cadet will not lie, cheat, or steal, or tolerate those who do. Mr. Bush, it seems to us that you and your ilk have done exactly the opposite. And you are still cooking up war stories, unalloyed of truth, further proving it, if such were still necessary, that lying, even under your combat imagining, jeopardizes the lives of fighting men and women. And Saturday, you told the graduating class that, quote, "The war began on my watch, but it's going to end on yours," end quote. Perhaps you would like to correct that statement. Perhaps consider adding what is now widely known, that the assault on Iraq began premised on lies. That is illegal. That these lies have severely dissipated the capability, morale, and reputation of the United States military forces and the United States of America. And that the young men and women of West Point in this year's graduating class may also be soon at risk for crimes against the Geneva Convention, and that you don't give a damn for anything we just said. Well, I think if you're going to be told by somebody from West Point, that pretty much does it. The writer of that little gem is a graduate from West Point, and I don't have the name here. I will give that name to you tomorrow, the gentleman that wrote that letter. But he doesn't like Mr. Bush's stories. And isn't it something how he saunters up to the podium when he's at a place like that and acts like he's one of them? Yeah, I'm one of you. I'm one of you. I've got a lot of war stories, and I'm the commander-in-chief, you see. I'm in charge here. I'm in charge. I'm a big man. I'm a big Texas man, and I'm in charge. I'm George Bush. What an attitude this little guy has. What a sick little attitude this guy has. I'm so ashamed that he's the President of the United States. I know I've said that many times, but I am. I'm so ashamed, and I grow even more ashamed every single day. Every single day that he occupies the Oval Office, I become more and more ashamed. When he said, God, that he was going to restore the dignity and honor to that office after Clinton was in it, and how many million people bought that deal? Has he restored dignity and honor to the office of the presidency of the United States? Do you think he has? Do you think he's dignified? I take that back. That's a stupid question. Dignity is not something that George Bush has ever had, nor will he ever have. You've heard the story about him being seated next to the Queen and addressed her as, not that I'm that crazy about the royalty in England, but he sat down between the beside the Queen at a state dinner and said, "Hi, Queen, how you doing?" This is a very dignified man. Very dignified. This is a very dignified man who recently said, told Prime Minister Howard from Australia, really said at the podium at the White House when he's introducing him, said, "Well, now he may not be a good-looking man, but he is a good friend of the United States." God, dignity. That's one thing. The other thing is honor. Honor. It's a huge word. Huge word. One of the biggest in the English language is honor. It means so many things to so many people. But its basic meaning means the same to all people. And honor is something that George Bush does not possess. Never has, never will. In his life story, you cannot see honor. You can hunt all you want to, and you will not find it. For he has none. He has displayed this over and over and over again, that he has no honor. A man that would start a war on the basis of lies has no honor. A man that will continue a war that he knows is wrong, not only for our folks, but for the folks that we've invaded, that man has no honor. A man that can see the atrocities that have taken place, not just in Abu Ghraib, and not just in Haditha, but other places in Iraq. A man that can see that and not do anything about it for all intents and purposes has no honor. A man that says that he will get rid of anybody in the White House that leaks and knows already that it was he and his vice president that did the leaking. A man that sits and makes a statement like that to the American public has no honor. I could go on and on and on, and you know I could go on for hours over that. You know that. I'm not making that up. Don't have to make any of it up. The man is totally devoid of honor. Well, that's all we have time for today. I wish it could go on right now because I would like to talk about that. Perhaps we'll talk about it a little bit tomorrow. Would like to remind you that you've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. You've heard the Guy James Show. We'll see you tomorrow.